From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we remember Peter Fonda, who died last week at the age of 79. The son of actor Henry Fonda and brother of Jane Fonda, he made a name for himself and a reputation as a counterculture sex symbol in the film Easy Rider, about two hippie bikers on a wild cross-country trip. Fonda wanted his motorcycle in the film to have a certain look.
All that steel and all that engine between my legs and that red, white, and blue and star-spangled gas tank, I thought it was like a huge phallic symbol that I'd be riding across the country.
And that's you wanted.
Well, exactly.
We'll listen back to Terry's 1998 interview with Fonda. Also, Ken Tucker tells us about some late summer songs he's been listening to, and John Powers reviews the new Netflix documentary American Factory, the first in a series produced by the Obamas. Actor Peter Fonda died last Friday in Los Angeles. He was 79. Fonda was part of an intergenerational Hollywood family, the son of Henry Fonda, the sister of Jane Fonda, and father of Bridget Fonda. Peter Fonda had an acting career of more than 50 years, with two Oscar nominations decades apart. The first, in 1969, was for the screenplay for Easy Rider, which he co-wrote with Dennis Hopper and Terry Southern. Fonda also starred in the film, which became a counterculture classic, as a free-spirited motorcycle rider. And he earned a Best Actor nomination for the 1997 film Yulee's Gold, where he played Yulee Jackson, a Vietnam vet and beekeeper. That was the occasion for Terry's interview with Peter Fonda, and they began with a clip from Yulee's Gold. In the film, Yulee's son is in prison for bank robbery. His daughter-in-law is a drug addict who's abandoned the children and left them with Yulee. Two of his son's robbery partners think the son hid the money from the robbery on Yulee's farm, and they're determined to find it. In this scene, Yulee's visiting his son, who wants Yulee to track down his wife.
That's why you gotta go get her. Right now, while we know where she is, before Eddie or Ferris do something.
Get her. And then what? She left her kids. Your kids. Remember, this is my busiest time. I'm supposed to risk everything to go bring back a gun. As far as I'm concerned, she can just stay gone.
She's sick, Dad.
I don't know nothing about dealing with scum like Eddie and Ferris. Besides, you think she's gonna let me go in there? Take her off just like that?
You're all we got, Pop.
Peter Fonda, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're playing someone in Yulee's Gold who's very, very inward, very reserved, someone who's surrounded by people much more volatile than he is. You write in your book that this part demanded the kind of performance only actors like your father give. What do you mean by that?
Very understated, putting very little spin on the line, letting the moment play for itself. But that means you have to know what the moment is, find it and fill it, and then let it go.
What does that mean, find the moment and then let it go?
The heaviest line in the film was when my character says to Eddie and Ferris that, the line is, meeting someone like you, Eddie, has done me a world of good. And he says, how's that? I said, it reminds me that there's all kinds of weakness in the world. Not all of it is evil. I forget that from time to time. You read that line flat, no spin on it. The power of the line is still there. It's like when I said we blew it at the end of Easy Rider. I threw that line away. I said, you know what, Billy? We blew it, flatlined it. It allows the power to come through more than if you try to over-dramatize it. This is what my father was famous for. And many other actors, in that, for that matter. It's doing less and making more of it.
Has your role in Yulee's Gold led to other interesting offers?
Yes, I just finished The Passion of Ayn Rand with Helen Mirren, who is really cool.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She's dynamic. I love her. And I believe that the offer that came to me to play Frank O'Connor, Ayn Rand's husband, and when I read the script, I said, God, I'm just a piece of furniture in the background. How come they're offering me so much money? Then I said, oh, well, I guess what I'll be is the most comfortable chair you can imagine. So everyone who sees me will say, ooh, we want to stop and sit in that chair. And I found out how to do even more with even less than I had in Yulee. I was in every scene in Yulee's Gold doing less. But I wasn't in every scene. After all, it's not called The Passion of Frank O'Connor. It's The Passion of Ayn Rand. So I learned how to do a scene with one word. It's just the way I inflected and the way I say it, like, well, or well. And it was, as a matter of fact, the word well at one point. And Helen was just acting her buns off, being Ayn Rand. Spooky, very cool. And she says all this stuff, and she's jabbering away in the back of a limousine, and I say, well. And Chrisman, all the directors, said, okay, cut, that's fine, check the gates, that was perfect. And Helen looked at me and started hitting me over the head with pages from the script. Damn, I am working my ass here, and you get away with just saying well, and you steal the scene. You know, that's a wonderful compliment coming from right. Helen Mirren.
The roles that you first really became famous for were biker roles. So before we get to some of those roles, how did you first meet Dennis Hopper, who was your collaborator?
Right. I met Dennis at the reception to his wedding to a person named Brooke Hayward, whom I'd grown up with and was like kind of my older sister, like Jane. But not really like Jane in the long run. We all kind of got damaged together, you might say. And so at her wedding, I was there. The reception was held in my sister's apartment in New York in 1916. That's when I met Dennis the first time.
And what hooked you up together? I mean, what did you see in each other?
A certain energy and frustration and the ability to collaborate, to break through that, and the ability to find ideas that were new and different. And fortunately for me, I got turned on to some of the great bits of American art. The artists themselves, their work, the pop art scene, everything Dennis was into, I just absorbed like a sponge. So he was a gateway to lots of cool things that were happening in my life.
Well, you wrote a screenplay together called Ying and Yang, and I think it was that screenplay that led you to Roger Corman. And Roger Corman cast you in his film Wild Angels, which was about bikers, about the Hell's Angels.
Notice how you had to stammer just for a second. It was about, what was it about?
Yeah, well, this was a, you know, you're like, you know, the leader of a Hell's Angels gang. A kind of real switch from previous roles that you had in movies like Tammy and the Doctor and Lilith. What did you think of yourself as being the biker?
Well, I mean, I liked the job I did in Lilith. I thought I fit the bill well. And in my later years now, I'm enjoying hearing that from people. But I didn't want to be cast as the sensitive roles all the time, and that's what my agents had in mind for me. They thought they wanted me to become the next Dean Jones for Disney. I had other thoughts afoot here. I was a bit too radical for that. So I started to strike out in a different way.
Now, what do you think Corman cast you in the biker role?
I think he saw me as this very rebellious person who didn't give a rat's ass and went out there and just did what was most, I guess, obnoxious, or at least what shook the cage, whatever would shake the cage the most into any kind of really set in legislative morality. I really believe that abstract morality has no place in our political or our everyday lives, and I mean, arbitrary morality and abstract authority certainly doesn't, so he saw me as somebody who was always watching for something to step on that looked like abstract authority or arbitrary morality. It's been a long time since I've had to talk about arbitrary morality, but a very funny thing happened to me in my life. I came over to my dad's house post-Easy Rider. You know, I figured it's a family house, so I'm part of the family. Truck on in, you don't have to call and ask for permission. And ran into my father and three of his agents and lawyer types, his business managers and lawyer types, and his fifth wife, Shirley. And I walked on in and sat down, just listening to what was going on. And somehow or other, and I really don't remember exactly how, I wish I did, the conversation turned against me about how, as I didn't believe in the laws governing the use of marijuana, did not give me the right to break that law. You know, laws were laws, and they were made to be kept, and there was a reason for laws. And I said, you know, these guys just stepped on the landmine. They don't even know it. Wait till they step off, and it clicks, and they're gone. because I said, well, now hold on, you guys. There is a law in the state of California on the books that forbids oral copulation.
And well, this is a great way to endear yourself to your family.
Oh, by this time, my family...
Too late.
Yeah, you got it.
Right.
And they'd all skated. I was the family.
So listen, when you were cast in Wild Angels, were you already riding a motorcycle?
Yeah, I'd been riding around a lot with various other glitterati, McQueen and Brando, myself, Ted Marklin, people that...
Oh, boy, it would have been fun to see you and Brando, who had also played a biker, riding around together.
Oh, yeah, actually, he asked me to come by his house one afternoon. He said, come by my house. I left my motorcycle down at Wally Cox's. Would you take me down there? I said, sure, bud. We called him Bud because that was what he was known as a young man in Omaha. And I said, yeah, bud, I'll come by. He said, but bring your Bonneville. I had a Triumph Bonneville. You know, I thought maybe a car would suffice, but oh, sure, you can ride in the back of my motorcycle. As we're riding down Ventura Boulevard, trying to beat the rain, Marla leaned forward and whispered in my ear, did you hate your father? I thought to myself, that's the strangest question to have come from this dude who's holding on his arms around me. I'm wondering, why does he have his arms around me? What am I in for with Marlon here?
What'd you say?
I just said no. Right. In the long run, Marlon, no. And I knew that I loved my father. I was confused and wondered whether he loved me.
I think it's time to hear a scene from Wild Angels, your first biker film. And now, in this scene, you're at the funeral of a biker played by Bruce Dern, and his coffin is covered by a Nazi flag. There's a minister delivering a eulogy, which you think is really phony, so you interrupt the eulogy to say this.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
I apologize. But tell me, just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. We want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. That's what we're gonna do.
Well, wait, baby, let's go.
We're gonna have a good time. We're gonna have a party.
Yeah! And as you can hear, they are totally tearing apart the church. Peter Fonda, your thoughts listening back to this scene?
Far out.
That's groovy first, would be the other alternative.
No, not groovy, just far out. And, you know, what the heck. You would have to pick that scene. I didn't write it.
Who did?
I can't remember.
How did those lines sound to you at the time? You want to be free to not be hassled by the man.
I thought I had a better way of saying it, but I was reminded that I was playing the leader of a motorcycle gang and didn't necessarily have that larger vocabulary.
Now, there is a poster of you from this movie that you say sold, what, 16 million copies in America or something like that?
Easily, yeah.
How seriously did you take yourself at the time as a biker icon?
I didn't even put those two things together. I was brought into Corman's office. He was over at 20th Century Fox. Had a deal making films over there. And he said he wanted to make, and my hair was rather long, and I was considered a weird hippie. And he said he wanted to make a motorcycle movie, a movie about the Hells Angels that wasn't making a statement, which I found to be rather far out, because I think anytime you make a movie about the Hells Angels, you're covering statement all over the place. So I thought, well, let's see if he can do it. I said, I'm in. And eventually I was called, and actually, the first time I was called to play Bruce Dern's part.
The loser.
The loser, yeah. And I said, oh, I can do this one easily. Anyway, it turned out that the fellow who's cast to play the part that I ended up playing didn't know how to ride a motorcycle, so I got the gig. But at the same price, I got to play for being the loser, who's a stiff for about a third of the film.
Right. Now, it's funny, when you were young and going to boarding school and private school, you write that you had the image of being a sissy, and for a while you were even called Fairy Fonda. That was in part because you had to play the role of a fair maiden in the Pirates of Penzance at an all-boys school.
Also, the fact that I weighed probably 82 pounds.
Yeah, you were real, like, skinny marink at the time. Anyways, it's a kind of far cry from that image, you know, from the sissy image that you had to, you know, the biker.
Worked.
Did you like that change? Did you find it amusing, or did you take it really seriously?
Well, that particular part of the change I found very amusing. And even writing the script with Dennis, it was a lot of fun and an amusement to it. I was definitely bent to do something different in my life, and I went for it. Next film, what are you going to do next? Let me find out if I should chain myself to this chair and handcuff myself so I don't come crawling through the mic.
I have a question about Roger Corman's The Trip, but you'll be spared from any clips.
Oz, roll the clips. I can handle it.
Okay. This is an LSD movie with lots of, like, swirling psychedelic colors intercut in the trip scenes. Now, I imagine you were already tripping a lot yourself when you shot this movie.
No, you couldn't really do that. I think I'd end up looking at the camera and just starting to crack up, thinking these guys are really serious, aren't they?
No, I don't mean while making the movie, but I mean, I don't mean you were high during the shooting of the movie necessarily, but you already knew a lot about acid trips by the time you made the movie, right?
Not a lot, I think, probably. I only took my reputation for consumption far exceeds the actual amount of controlled substances that I ever attempted or tried. But I knew what it was. I knew what it was. I had an altered state several times before Roger and I talked about making a movie about that thing, and I tried to get Roger to go for it, too, so he'd know what an altered state was, because I was very specific, and I said, it's not, you know, about flashing lights and swirling things overlaid on images on film. That's what you see in the discotheques, because they don't know how to recreate it. And Jack Nicholson wrote the script, and Jack's script was absolutely brilliant. He did it all with stock footage, some footage that we would shoot, in a cutting matter. In other words, he made the rhythm of the cuts and what the visual image was against your eyes into an altered state. It was a brilliant thing, and Roger copped to the flashing lights and swirling things, overlaid images of the rest of us, which rather disappointed me. But the good part about it all was first that I got to work with Dennis Hopper, who was in the film in a supporting role, by telling Roger, who was not going to shoot some of the images that were really necessary to make something out of it. And Dennis and I went off with the camera and film to the desert and shot stuff of me running through sand dunes and things like that. They intercut very well, but you sure could see the difference in the footage we shot compared to the footage that Roger shot.
Now, how did you and Dennis Hopper decide to do Easy Rider, your own version of a biker film?
I was in Toronto, Canada, in September of 1967, attending a big convention of theater owners and exhibitors and distributors. And at the second day of lunch with 1,200 people, I was up at a big table. I had a very nice, custom-made, double-breasted suit and really cool shirt and tie and no shoes or socks. So everybody would come in to visit me, to interview me, just couldn't take their eyes off the fact that I had bare feet, and they just stare at the bare feet, which was, of course, the desired effect. And actually, the day before, when I was given my lesson by Jack Valenti, he looked right at me as I was sitting down on the floor with the rest of the plebes and said, "We have to stop making movies about motorcycles, sex, and drugs, and start making more movies like Dr. Doolittle, which cost $27 million. And I went back to my room. Okay, no more sex, motorcycles, sex, and drugs movie. But I'd come up with this story the night before I said that line of Easy Rider. Called Dennis on the phone. It was 4:30 Toronto time on the 27th of September, 1967. And 1:30 in L.A. time, and I called Dennis, told him the story that I'd made up, and he said, "That's far out. What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I thought you'd direct it, I'll produce it, we both write it and act in it, and we could save some money, and I believe we'd make a movie that would be commercially successful." And that's how it started.
What did you want your motorcycle to look like for the movie?
just what it looked like, all that steel and all that engine between my legs and that red, white, and blue and star-spangled gas tank. I thought it was like a huge phallic symbol that I'd be riding across the country.
And that's you wanted.
Well, exactly. And Dennis wanted me in white leathers, and I said, no, this is an evil Knievel. We stay in black leathers. We don't want to count out the S&M crowd from this movie. We want to get as many people in here as possible, and black leather plays a lot better, believe me, Dennis. And so, at any rate, I put spurs on even. Very few people realize that I was wearing spurs during that movie. I was trying to tell you we were making a Western that happened to have sex and drugs and motorcycles in it.
Peter Fonda speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1998. Fonda died last week in Los Angeles. He was 79. After a break, we'll hear more of the interview. Also, Ken Tucker tells us about some of his favorite late summer songs, and John Powers reviews the new Netflix documentary American Factory, the first in a series produced by the Obamas. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Curio Collection by Hilton. With all Curio Collection by Hilton hotels, there's something more to discover. Take the foodie-forward resorts of Sai Lagoon in the Maldives and the Iguerone Hotel in Spain. Iguerone's Michelin-starred chef Diego Gallegos romances palates with multicultural and environmentally friendly dishes. Sai Lagoon takes personalization to a new level by using natural ingredients to create unique plates for each guest. Are you curious? Visit Hilton.com/NPR.
We're listening to Terry's 1998 interview with actor Peter Fonda, who died last week at the age of 79. Fonda is best remembered for his role as a free-spirited motorcycle rider in the 1969 film Easy Rider.
You say in your book that as soon as you had your motorcycle and your leathers, you started riding the L.A. freeway at night to practice, I guess, but you were stopped every night by the police. What were those encounters like?
Well, I was stopped because I was wearing the flag on the back. I had the costume on, and I had the flag in the back of my jacket, and they thought I was degrading the flag. So they would arrest me, and, of course, I made sure that I didn't have any money with me. I had my driver's license and Platinum American Express card, but no money. And they would bust me for vagrancy and take me down. Eventually, they'd have to let me go and bring me back to my motorcycle, and off I'd go and riding around. After the success of the film in 1969, by 1970, every cop car had a flag on its fender, every cop had a flag on his sleeve, and it suddenly was hip to wear flags wherever you wanted them all the time. It was more of an homage than it was something against the country. I got the idea, by the way, from John Wayne in Flying Tigers, only I decided that a national Chinese flag wouldn't really work too well in Easy Rider.
Now, time for another scene.
Uh-oh.
In this scene...
This news is getting tighter every time you do this. But I can handle it. I can handle it.
This is one of your scenes in Easy Rider with Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson is an alcoholic lawyer. And in this scene, you're giving him his first joint. You're convincing him. You're convincing him to try marijuana. Let's hear the scene.
Go ahead, George. Light it up.
Oh, no. I couldn't do that. I mean, I've got enough problems with the booze and all. I mean, I can't afford to get hooked.
Huh. You won't get hooked.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, it leads to harder stuff. That, you say it's all right. Well, all right, then, how do I do it?
Here.
Well, that's got a real nice, taste to it, though. I don't suppose it'll do me much good, though. I mean, I'm so used to the booze and everything.
You've got to hold it in your lungs longer, George.
Your memories of shooting that scene?
Well, you can't see me in my end of the world. I was running all the lines, lip-syncing them to the folks in our engineering room just for the heck of it. Yeah, I remember that. Of course, there's these long pauses, and you wonder what's going on. It's intercutting between me and Jack and the looks I'm giving it, because I don't really make a comment about whether the grass is good or bad or getting hooked. I just look at him and smile.
Now, what did your father, Henry Fonda, think of Easy Rider and your image as, you know, the countercultural movie star who rode a motorcycle and went on, you know, trips of both kinds, the acid and road kind?
Well, I'm sure that he wasn't thrilled with the whole thing, but he knew that I was very serious as a producer and that I had put this thing down as an original story and then co-wrote it with Dennis and Terry Southern into a screenplay.
In movie terms, it made a fortune. I mean, you know, you did good.
Yeah, but
you
didn't know
good,
that yet.
So, right,
and
right.
I knew we would make some money, and therefore mm-hmm. Dennis and I would have a track record, and we could make another motion picture. It was later into it that I realized how far out it would go. And my dad, by this time, by the way, I realized we were going to go to a much broader audience than I figured mm-hmm. originally. My dad said, you know, this is pretty thin here. I don't think people are going to understand what's happening. I mean, we don't know where you're going. I said, well, Dad, why don't you take the trip with us and find out what we find out, discover what we discover. He said, well, that's pretty thin. I mean, where are you going? We need to know so we can take that trip with you. And I said, well, Dennis says, I'm going down to Mardi Gras. I'm going to get me a Mardi Gras queen in the first campfire. Dad said, well, son, that's a little bit thin. I don't think that'll hang in there. I don't think we'll stay with you. And I'm worried for you because I know you got all your eggs in this basket. And he was entitled to his opinion, which was probably the way the most of the establishment, liberal or conservative, saw the particular movie. But what he hadn't factored in fact, I wish I was smart enough to say that I factored in, was as the flower children and hippies came into being, we had our own language, we had our own art, we had our own poetry, music, our whole morality or customs. What we didn't have was our own movie. And when Easy Rider popped on, that became our own movie, and that transcended everything else and became the icon that it was.
Now, later in life, you were in a motorcycle accident, and you broke your back and broke your neck.
The neck was the second time.
The second time you broke your neck in a motorcycle accident?
Mm-mm. Just the second time I broke my neck.
How'd you break it the first time?
Oh, I was thrown out of a barn window when I was 6 years old at a boarding school in Topanga Canyon. I was sent away to first grade in order to make a man out of me. Now, you try to put together the logic of a six-year-old becoming a man. All I was a target for the older boys who were kind of problem boys and sent to this farm school for that reason. And beaten up, or sand was put in my bed. Basically, life was made real miserable for me, and it was the beginning of my understanding how society was going to treat Henry Fonda's son. Anyway, these jokers threw me out of a barn window about 25 feet down onto some hard earth, and I hit it with my chin and the palms of my hand. And I would find out later in 1985, when I had my second bad motorcycle accident, that I had broken my neck when I was 6 years old. Because the doctor's looking at the x-rays. I was kind of strapped to this very straight chair, and the doctor's looking at the x-rays were saying, I look it over here, look at the ribs. And I said, the ones on the left side, those are Jack Nicholson. He broke them by slamming his legs together when he thought the bike was getting out of control, crossing one more bridge. And they said, look at the neck here. And I said, ooh, gosh, the neck to myself. You know, looking at my toes and fingers and realizing I can move them and I can move my head. So nothing's severed yet. Yeah, but look down here. And the radiologist said, well, that's a really old break. And all the doctors agreed that it was an old break. Right. And the lead doctor turned to me and he said, do you remember having a trauma to your head when you were 6 or 7? Bang. Oh.
Did you ride a bike again after you broke your back and your neck?
Not for 5 years.
But do you ride it now?
Oh, yeah.
Now, I want to go back to the very beginning, you know, when you were a kid. Where was your father in his career when you were a child, when you were like 5 or 6?
That's a hard one. I remember we visited him on the set of Fort Apache, which was the first time we saw him on a set, at least the first time I saw him on a set. But otherwise, we were kind of not sure what he did. You know, we weren't positive about it. At least I wasn't. I thought maybe my mom had all the money and Dad was just having a good time. And as it ended up, later I found out what kind of work acting was really all about.
Your father's movies kept him away from home and from you a lot of the time. Did you resent his movie career?
Actually, I was the lucky one. After the debacle of the Barton School for Boys up in Topanga Canyon, I was I was kept at home and tutored at home. So when my father was in between movies, I got to see him more often than my sisters did. And so I was a lucky one of the crowd. But he made a lot of, I was born in 1940. Between 1940 and when he went off to fight in the Second World War in 1943, he made 12 movies.
Wow. Was he a very strict father with you?
He was strict, but I mean, he didn't carry a bullwhip. But he was very critical of Jane and me. Very quick to criticize, and
what was he down on you for?
I suppose anything. Well, as an example, I remember one night when it's in the dining room table, God announced, because whenever Dad would say something, it was like an announcement from God, and with an angry face at that, God announced, "Where is the salt shaker?" Oh, man, I buried my hands, and I thought, oh, my goodness, I left it out on the lawn, because I'd been told by my mother that the way to catch birds was to pour salt on their tails. And, of course, I spent many hours crawling across the grass on my belly with a salt shaker in my hand. It took me a long time to find out the euphemism was, if you got close enough to the bird to put salt on his tail, you could catch the damn thing. But I didn't, you know. Meanwhile, I'd leave the salt shaker out there and have suffer the consequences of such a very, I think, funny and childish thing, but it was a major no-no, like, who ate the apple? You know, God was asking, who ate the apple? One time when he came home on leave, I went to look at his personal things. I always did that with my parents, wondering what they meant, what these talismans were in their life. And I went and looked at his dog tags and stuff and pulled a piece of candy out of this huge brandy snifter that was where he kept pennies and pieces of candy in his dressing room. He came back out and sat on the couch next to him, sucking on a candy. I think it was licorice. And he asked me, where did I get the candy? But the way he said it was like, who got the apple out of the tree? And, you know, I realized, uh-oh, I'm in for a big time. I just found it. Liar. And I jumped off that couch. Man, I was upstairs faster than Rayford Johnson could have made it upstairs, even at my weight and age. Got into my bathroom and locked the door. Of course, it was an early American lock, and it held only through two kicks for my father to kick in the door. And he spanked me with what I assumed to be the world's largest hairbrush. There was a much better way to have dealt the story of not telling the truth or whatever it might be, or not asking permission to have a piece of candy, than breaking down the door to the bathroom. I never did that to my kids.
When you and your sister Jane were kids, did you have any clue that you would actually pursue acting careers yourselves, or did you both think as kids that you'd head in some completely opposite direction?
How old are kids?
So you went through different phases on this?
No, I mean, I appeared in plays and stuff during school. I didn't realize it was a job till way late in the game, but it was 19 and in college that I discovered that's what I wanted to do. I desperately wanted to sing, but that's what I wanted to do. As for Jane and how she came to the decision, I don't know. I remember things happening in her life, but she never said to me, guess what, you know, I'm going to do this. She just was there doing it.
Are you surprised that your daughter, Bridget, has become an actress too?
Yeah, except that she's extraordinarily beautiful, and she has great presence, and she has talent and knows how to work it. See, these things aren't passed on genetically, or I would have been manipulating my genes a long time ago.
Well, Peter Fonda, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Peter Fonda speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1998. Fonda died last week in Los Angeles. He was 79. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker shares some of his favorite late summer songs. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Have you ever needed a doctor late at night or while traveling? Teladoc offers 24/7 access to board-certified doctors for non-emergency conditions like a sinus infection, allergies, flu, rashes, and more. Teladoc's board-certified doctors can diagnose, treat, and where authorized, prescribe medication to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/freshair.
While you were sleeping, a whole lot of news was happening around the world. Up first is the NPR News podcast that gets you caught up on the big news in a small amount of time. Spend about 10 minutes with Up First, weekday mornings from NPR News.
Summer's almost over, but that hasn't stopped musicians from releasing summertime music. Rock critic Ken Tucker's been listening to songs that qualify as catchy hot weather fun, and he's chosen three of them to close out the summer season. Here are his reviews of new music by Alicia Cara, Megan Thee Stallion, and Bon Iver.
Got me feeling like the elephant in every room I'm walking into, yeah. We started out innocent till I got pulled right into your issue, yeah. I'm tired of sending hugs and kisses, I'm tired of all you.
Alicia Cara gets to her point early on in her new single, Rooting For You. Addressing a friend who's not being nice to her, she sings, "Why you gotta be so cold in the summertime?" The warm weather has not inspired warm feelings. With its acoustic guitar rhythm over a synthesizer beat, Rooting For You is a catchy piece of contradiction. Its positive title is revealed to be the reverse. Hey, fickle friend, I'm not rooting for you anymore.
Now I see you having so much fun with everyone. You had so much fun making fun of. Did you come and bump your head? Did you forget where you came from? I'm tired of sending my well wishes. I'm tired of all your.
When it comes to trying for a seasonal hit, song titles don't get more on the nose than this one called Hot Girl Summer. It's a new single by the rapper Megan Thee Stallion.
Here's what it is, this some fast start. She a big old freak, it's a must that I hit. It's a hot girl summer, so you know she got it lit. Know she got it lit. Hot girl summer, so you know she got it lit. Know she got it lit.
Handle me? Who gon' handle me? Thinking he's a player, he's a member on the team. He put in all that work, he wanna be the MVP. I told him ain't no taming me, I love my just equally. Fucking 9 to 5 with that superstar deep. The superstar star, now I got him far late. I called a jet to get that nigga, I told him call, don't send no. Tell him you with me when they be asking where you at. I can't read your mind, gotta say that. Should I take your love, should I take that? Got a whole lot of options, cause you know a girl's hopping. I'm a high girl, so you know she's stopping.
Megan Thee Stallion has made one of the best hip-hop albums of the year, called Fever, a collection that is also so explicit it can't be played on the radio. A college student currently completing a degree in health administration, Megan is helped out on Hot Girl Summer by guest star Nicki Minaj in a playful back-and-forth about female empowerment. By contrast, you might say that my final summer song is about male disempowerment. It's from the new album by Bon Iver, and the song is called You Man Like.
I will see you off from now down the back of the ridge. There's just something that I got to show you. There is Domer and his ride in the common case. It ain't nothing what you say is true.
With your long arms trapped.
You Man Like, the title is an inversion of the phrase Man Like You, is an elegantly stark piano ballad with a soaring vocal chorus. Bon Iver's mastermind, singer-songwriter Justin Vernon, has cited Bruce Hornsby among his influences, and Hornsby sings a line on that song. You Man Like is a high point on Bon Iver's uneven new album called I. This has been a season dominated by the massive success of Lil Nas X's country rap Old Town Road. But songs as various as the three I've played here are a necessary expansion of the sounds of summer to accommodate all kinds of sounds and all kinds of moods.
rock critic Ken Tucker. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new Netflix documentary American Factory, the first in a series produced by the Obamas. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org. Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting the podcast Eleanor Amplified, an adventure series kids love and will make those summer road trips a little easier on everyone. Hear reporter Eleanor outwit crafty villains and solve mysteries as she travels the globe to get the big story. Available where you get podcasts or at WHYY.org.
American Factory is a prize-winning documentary that's the first release on Netflix from Higher Ground Productions, the new company headed by Barack and Michelle Obama. Directed by Julia Reichert and Stephen Bogner, it shows what happens when a Chinese company opens a factory in Ohio. Our critic John Power says it's a smart, compassionate look at work in the age of globalization.
In the 1960s, there was a terrific comedy in which a teenage Maoist scrawled a bit of graffiti that would become famous. China is near. Half a century on, China is here. It's here on our screens where Hong Kong protests domination by the communist mainland. It's here in the tariff war between President Trump and Chairman Xi. And of course, it's here inside the cell phones we all worship. China's arrival in the American workplace is the subject of a fine new Netflix documentary, American Factory, by Julia Reichert and Stephen Bogner, who spent years chronicling blue-collar lives. Set on the outskirts of their home city of Dayton, Ohio, this measured, deeply moving film takes a familiar idea, the notion of an American factory, and shows how tricky that concept has become in today's globalized economy. The story begins with a 2008 prologue in which General Motors shutters its Moraine, Ohio plant, chucking 2,400 union workers out of work and into years of desperate struggle. Then in 2015 comes hope. The Chinese company Fuyao, which makes glass for automobiles, decides to reopen the plant and hire 1,000 locals. Led by its self-made billionaire owner, Chairman Cao, who looks, alas, like a caricature of a fat cat tycoon, Fuyao brings along 200 experienced Chinese employees to oversee production. At first, things go okay. True, a worker like Shanae Rosser is making only $12.84 an hour, way down from the $28 an hour she earned at GM. And true, the Chinese are frustrated that the Americans work so slowly. They have fat fingers, one says. Still, everyone wants the factory to succeed. Furnace supervisors like Rob Hare and Wong He become friends, while others seek to understand their cultural differences. And when it comes to work, these are profound. We see this in two contrasting Fuyao celebrations. In the first, a few Ohio workers fly to China and watch the company's New Year festivities, a heavily scripted display of totalitarian kitsch, complete with dancing girls and little kids singing about teamwork and corporate success. The second is the American Factory's opening ceremony, at which Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown startles and enrages Cao and his American execs by saying he hopes the plant will be unionized. If you think American capitalists don't like unions, try the Chinese communists. While Americans expect 8-hour days with vacations and benefits, Fuyao management is used to Chinese employees who work 12-hour shifts with one day off a month, often sharing dorm-like apartments. The bosses think Americans lazy for talking on the job. Meanwhile, the Americans grow dispirited by the relentless factory regimen, as one of them tells us in a tone that speaks volumes.
The conditions are not favorable. Doing the same thing over and over again, that wears on your body, mind, your soul. It's sometimes you think, why am I doing this? you think about whether you have the stamina and the will to do this type of job.
Reichert and Bogner are clearly on the side of the workers, both American and Chinese. Yet their film is no Michael Moore polemic. It's an old-school observational documentary in the very best sense of the term. They don't approach the Fu Yao story with a thesis, don't dehumanize the Chinese, don't tell us what to think. Working with 1,200 hours of footage, heroically edited by Lindsay Utz, they have amazing access to a complex economic reality that's touchingly hard on workers like Jill LaMantia, John Crane, and Timmy Jernigan, to name a few more key characters. Eventually, many of Fu Yao's American workers get fed up with the factory's cramped, hectoring conditions. I won't say what happens, but watching events play out is an education in the workings of the global economy. From the factory floor to the boardroom, everyone is caught in the logic of the market, which defines everything in terms of the bottom line. If you don't help maximize profit, you're gone. We're not surprised when Cao starts to replace his workers with robots. Reichert and Bogner capture a reality facing millions of Americans. Even as their wages go down and they long for the comfortable lives folks like them once could afford, workers in China, whose low pay has driven down wages all over the Western world, enjoy a prosperity they've never before known. Life's looking rosier for them. Their 12-hour workday, without time off or benefits, represents the rising model of labor in 21st century capitalism. Near the end of American Factory, Chairman Cao strolls outside a glassy pillared mansion that contains what looks like a shrine to himself. The point of living is to work, he says. Don't you think so? It's hard to think of a sadder or scarier line in any movie this year.
John Powers reviewed the new documentary American Factory, now on Netflix. On Monday's show, we begin a week of interviews with this year's Emmy Award nominees, and we start with two Saturday Night Live alums. Bill Hader stars in HBO's dark comedy Barry as a Marine veteran turned hitman who starts acting classes. And John Mulaney, who wrote for SNL and has had his own award-winning comedy special. He's nominated for hosting SNL. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Terry Gross returns Monday. I'm Dave Davies.